Chapter 7. At 10 a.m. Friday, 2 days post-verdict, the Peyton firm met in the pit, a large open space with unpainted sheetrock walls, lined with homemade bookshelves, and cluttered with a heavy collage of aerial photos, medical summaries, juror profiles, expert witness reports, and 100 other trial documents and exhibits. In the center of the room was a table of sorts. 4 large pieces of inch-thick plywood mounted on sawhorses and surrounded with a sad collection of metal and wooden chairs, almost all of which were missing a piece or two. The table had obviously been the center of the storm for the past 4 months, with piles of papers and stacks of law books. Sherman, a paralegal, had spent most of the previous day hauling out coffee cups, pizza boxes, Chinese food containers, and empty water bottles. He had also swept the concrete floors, though no one could tell. Their previous office, a 3-story building on Main Street, had been beautifully decorated, well-appointed, and spruced up each night by a cleaning service. Appearance and neatness were important back then. Now, they were just trying to survive. In spite of the dismal surroundings, the mood was light, and for obvious reasons. The marathon was over. The incredible verdict was still hard to believe. United by sweat and hardship, the tight-knit little firm had taken on the beast and won a big one for the good guys. Mary Grace called the meeting to order. The phones were put on hold because Tabby, the receptionist, was very much a part of the firm and was expected to participate in the discussion. Thankfully, the phones were beginning to ring again. Sherman and Rusty, the other paralegal, wore jeans, sweatshirts, no socks. Working in what was once a dime store, who could care about a dress code? Tabby and Vicky, the other receptionist, had abandoned nice clothes when both snagged dresses on the hand-me-down furniture. Only Olivia, the matronly bookkeeper, turned herself out each day in proper office attire. They sat around the plywood table sipping the same bad coffee they were now addicted to, and listened with smiles as Mary Grace did her recap. "There will be the usual post-trial motion," she was saying. "Judge Harrison has scheduled a hearing in 30 days, but we expect no surprises."
"Here's to Judge Harrison," Sherman said, and they toasted him with their coffee.
It had become a very democratic firm. Everyone present felt like an equal. Anyone could speak whenever he or she felt like it. Only first names were used. Poverty is a great equalizer. Mary Grace continued, "For the next few months, Sherman and I will handle the Baker case as it moves forward, and we will keep the other Bowmore cases current. Wes and Rusty will take everything else and start generating some cash."
Applause.
"Here's to cash," Sherman said, another toast.
He possessed a law degree from a night school, but had not been able to pass the bar exam. He was now in his mid-40s, a career paralegal who knew more law than most lawyers. Rusty was 20 years younger and contemplating med school. "While we're on the subject," Mary Grace continued, "Olivia has given me the latest red ink summary. Always a pleasure." She picked up a sheet of paper and looked at the numbers. "We are now officially 3 months behind in rent for a total of $4,500.
"Oh, please evict us," Rusty said.
"But the landlord is still our client, and he's not worried. All other bills are at least 2 months past due, except, of course, the phones and electricity. Salaries have not been paid in 4 weeks."
"Five,"
Sherman said. "Are you sure?" she asked.
"As of today. Today is payday, or at least it used to be."
"Sorry. 5 weeks past due. We should have some cash in a week if we can settle the Rainey case. We'll try to catch up."
"We're surviving," Tabby said.
She was the only single person in the firm. All others had spouses with jobs. Though budgets were painfully tight, they were determined to survive.
"How about the Peyton family?"
Vicky asked. "We're fine," Wes said. "I know you're concerned, thank you, but we're getting by just like you. I've said this 100 times, but I'll say it again. Mary Grace and I will pay you as soon as we possibly can. Things are about to improve."
"We're more concerned about you," Mary Grace added.
No one was leaving.
No one was threatening. A deal had been struck long ago, though it was not in writing. If and when the Bowmore case is paid off, the money would be shared by the entire firm. Maybe not equally, but everyone present knew they would be rewarded.
How about the bank? Rusty asked.
There were no secrets now. They knew Huffy had stopped by the day before, and they knew how much Second State Bank was owed.
I stiff-armed the bank, Wes said. If they push a little more, then we'll file Chapter 11 and screw them. I vote screw the bank, Sherman said.
It seemed to be unanimous around the room that the bank should get screwed, though everyone knew the truth. The lawsuit would not have been possible without Huffy's lobbying on their behalf and convincing Mr. Prickhead to raise the line of credit. They also knew that the Paytons would not rest until the bank was paid.
We should clear $12,000 from the Rainey case, Mary Grace said, and another $10,000 from the dog bite.
Maybe $15,000, Wes said.
Then what? Where's the next settlement?
Mary Grace threw this on the table for all to consider.
Gita?
Sherman said it was more of a suggestion. Wes looked at Mary Grace. Both gave blank looks to Sherman.
Who's Gita? Gita happens to be a client. Slip and fall at the Kroger store. Came in about 8 months ago.
There were some odd glances around the table. It was obvious that the two lawyers had forgotten one of their clients.
I don't recall that one, Wes admitted.
What's the potential? Mary Grace asked.
Not much. Shaky liability, maybe $20,000. I'll review the file with you on Monday.
Good idea, Mary Grace said, and quickly moved on to something else. I know the phones are ringing, and we are definitely broke, but we are not about to start taking a bunch of junk. No real estate or bankruptcies. No criminal cases unless they can pay the freight. No contested divorces. We'll do the quickies for $1,000, but everything must be agreed on. This is a personal injury firm, and if we get loaded down with the small stuff, we won't have time for the good cases. Any questions?
There's a lot of weird stuff coming in by phone, Tabby said, and from all over the country.
Just stick to the basics, Wes said. We can't handle cases in Florida or Seattle. We need quick settlements here at home, at least for the next 12 months.
How long will the appeals take?
Vicky asked.
18 to 24 months, Mary Grace answered. And there's not much we can do to push things along. It's a process, and that's why it's important to hunker down now and generate some fees elsewhere.
Which brings up another point, Wes said. The verdict changes the landscape dramatically. First, expectations are through the roof right now, and our other Bowmore clients will soon be pestering us. They want their day in court, their big verdict. We must be patient, but we can't let these people drive us crazy. Second, the vultures are descending on Bowmore. Lawyers will be chasing one another looking for clients. It will be a free-for-all. Any contact from another attorney is to be reported immediately. Third, the verdict places even greater pressure on Crane. Their dirty tricks will get even dirtier. They have people watching us. Trust no one. Speak to no one. Nothing leaves this office. All papers are shredded. As soon as we can afford it, we'll hire nighttime security. Bottom line, watch everyone and watch your backs.
This is fun, Vicky said. Like a movie.
Any questions?
Yes, Rusty said. Can Sherman and I start chasing ambulances again? It's been 4 months, you know, since the beginning of the trial. I really miss the excitement.
I haven't seen the inside of an ER in weeks, Sherman added. And I miss the sounds of the sirens.
It wasn't clear if they were joking or not, but the moment was humorous and good for a laugh. Mary Grace finally said,
I really don't care what you do. I just don't want to know everything.
Meeting adjourned, Wes said. And it's Friday. Everyone has to leave at noon. We're locking the doors.
See you Monday.
They picked up Mac and Liza from school, and after fast food for lunch, they headed south through the countryside for an hour until they saw the first sign for Lake Garland. The roads narrowed before finally turning to gravel. The cabin was at the dead end of a dirt trail, perched above the water on stilts and wedged into a tight spot where the woods met the shoreline. A short pier ran from the porch into the water, and beyond it, the vast lake seemed to stretch for miles. There was no other sign of human activity, either on the lake or anywhere around it. The cabin was owned by a lawyer friend in Hattiesburg, a man Wes had once worked for and who had declined to get involved in the Bowmore mess. That decision had seemed a wise one until about 48 hours ago. Now there was considerable doubt. The original idea had been to drive a few more hours to Destin and have a long weekend on the beach, but they simply couldn't afford it. They unloaded the car as they roamed through the spacious cabin, an A-frame with a huge loft, which Mac surveyed and declared perfect for another night of camping out. "We'll see," Wes said. There were three small bedrooms on the main level, and he planned to find a comfortable bed. Serious sleep was the goal for the weekend. Sleep and time with the kids. As promised, the fishing gear was in a storage room under the porch. The boat was winched at the end of the pier, and the children watched with anticipation as Wes lowered it into the water. Mary Grace fiddled with the life jackets and made sure both kids were properly secured. An hour after they arrived, she was tucked away comfortably under a quilt in a lounge chair on the porch, book in hand, watching the rest of her family inch across the blue horizon of Lake Garland, three small silhouettes in search of brim and crappie. It was mid-November, and red and yellow leaves were falling, twisting in the breeze and covering the cabin, the pier, and the water around it. There were no sounds. The small boat motor was too far away. The wind was too soft. The birds and wildlife were elsewhere for the moment. Perfect stillness. A rare event in any life, but one that she especially treasured now. She closed the book, closed her eyes, and tried to think of something unrelated to the past few months. Where would they be in 5 years? She concentrated on the future because the past was thoroughly consumed by the Baker case. They would certainly be in a house, though never again would they hock their future with a fat mortgage on a showy little castle in the suburbs. She wanted a home, nothing more. She no longer cared about imported cars and an expensive office and all the other toys that once seemed so important. She wanted to be a mother to her children, and she wanted a home to raise them in. Family and assets aside, she wanted more lawyers. Their firm would be larger and full of smart and talented lawyers who did nothing but pursue the creators of toxic dumps and bad drugs and defective products. One day, Peyton and Peyton would be known not for the cases it won, but for the crooks it hauled into court for judgment. She was 41 years old, and she was tired. But the fatigue would pass. The old dreams of full-time motherhood and a cushy retirement were forever forgotten. Crane Chemical had converted her into a radical and a crusader. After the last 4 months, she would never be the same. Enough. Her eyes were wide open. Every thought took her back to the case, to Jeanette Baker, the trial, Crane Chemical. She would not spend this quiet and lovely weekend dwelling on such matters. She opened her book and started to read. For dinner, they roasted hot dogs and marshmallows over a stone pit near the water, then sat on the pier in the darkness and watched the stars. The air was clear and cool, and they huddled together under a quilt. A distant light flickered on the horizon, and after some discussion, it was agreed upon that it was just a boat.
"Dad, tell a story," Mac said.
He was squeezed between his sister and his mother. "What kind of story?"
"A ghost story. A scary one."
His first thought was about the dogs of Bowmore. For years, a pack of stray dogs had roamed the outskirts of the town. Often in the dead of night, they shrieked and yelped and made more noise than a pack of coyotes. Legend held that the dogs were rabid and had been driven crazy because they drank the water. But he'd had enough of Bowmore. He remembered one about a ghost who walked on water in the night, looking for his beloved wife who had drowned. He began to tell it, and the children squeezed closer to their parents. Chapter 8. A uniformed guard opened the gates to the mansion, then nodded smartly to the driver as the long black Mercedes rushed by, in a hurry as always. Mr. Carl Trudeau had the rear seat alone, already lost in the morning's papers. It was 7:30 a.m., too early for golf or tennis, and too early for Saturday morning traffic in Palm Beach. Within minutes, the car was on Interstate 95, racing south. Carl ignored the market reports. Thank God the week was finally over. Crane closed at $19.50 the day before and showed no signs of finding a permanent floor. Though he would be forever known as one of the very few men who had lost $1 billion in a day, he was already plotting his next legend. Give him a year, and he'd have his billion back. In 2 years, he'd double all of it. 40 minutes later, he was in Boca Raton, crossing the waterway, headed for the clusters of high-rise condos and hotels packed along the beach. The office building was a shiny glass cylinder, 10 floors tall, with a gate and a guard, and not one word posted on a sign of any type. The Mercedes was waved through and stopped under a portico. A stern-faced young man in a black suit opened the rear door and said, "Good morning, Mr. Trudeau." "Good morning," Carl said and climbed out. "This way, sir." According to Carl's hasty research, the firm of Troy Hogan worked very hard at not being seen. It had no website, brochure, advertisements, listed phone numbers, or anything else that might attract clients. It was not a law firm because it was not registered with the state of Florida, or any other state for that matter. It had no registered lobbyists. It was a corporation, not a limited partnership or some other variety of association. It was unclear where the name originated because there was no record of anyone named Troy or Hogan. The firm was known to provide marketing and consulting services, but there was no clue as to the nature of this business. It was domiciled in Bermuda and had been registered in Florida for 8 years. Its domestic agent was a law firm in Miami. It was privately owned, and no one knew who owned it. The less Carl learned about the firm, the more he admired it. The principal was one Barry Reinhardt, and here the trail grew somewhat warmer. According to friends and contacts in Washington, Reinhardt had passed through D.C. 20 years earlier without leaving a fingerprint. He had worked for a congressman, the Pentagon, and a couple of mid-sized lobbying outfits, the typical resume of a million others. He left town for no apparent reason in 1990 and surfaced in Minnesota, where he ran the successful campaign of a political unknown who got elected to Congress. Then he went to Oregon, where he worked his magic in a Senate race. As his reputation began to rise, he abruptly quit doing campaigns and disappeared altogether. End of trail. Reinhardt was 48 years old, married and divorced twice, no children, no criminal record, no professional associations, no civic clubs. He had a degree in political science from the University of Maryland and a law degree from the University of Nevada. No one seemed to know what he was doing now, but he was certainly doing it well. His suite on the top floor of the cylinder was beautifully decorated with minimalist contemporary art and furniture. Carl, who spared no expense with his own office, was impressed. Barry was waiting at the door of his office. The two shook hands and exchanged the usual pleasantries as they took in the details of the other's suit, shirt, tie, shoes. Nothing off the rack, no detail left undone, even though it was a Saturday morning in South Florida. Impressions were crucial, especially to Barry, who was thrilled at the prospect of snaring a new and substantial client. Carl had half expected a slick car salesman with a bad suit, but he was pleasantly surprised. Mr. Reinhardt was dignified, soft-spoken, well-groomed, and very much at ease in the presence of such a powerful man. He was certainly not an equal, but he seemed to be comfortable with this. A secretary asked about coffee as they stepped inside and met the ocean. From the 10th floor beachside, the Atlantic stretched forever. Carl, who gazed at the Hudson River several times a day, was envious.
Beautiful,
he said, staring from the row of 10-foot glass windows.
Not a bad place to work, Barry said.
They settled into beige leather chairs as the coffee arrived. The secretary closed the door behind her, giving the place a nice, secure feel.
I appreciate you meeting me on a Saturday morning, and with such short notice, Carl said. The pleasure is mine, Barry said. It's been a rough week.
I've had better. I take it you've spoken personally with Senator Grott.
Oh, yes. We chat occasionally.
He was very vague about your firm and what you do. Barry laughed and crossed his legs.
We do campaigns. Have a look.
He picked up a remote and pushed the button, and a large white screen dropped from the ceiling and covered most of a wall. Then the entire nation appeared. Most of the states were in green. The rest were in a soft yellow.
39 states elect their appellate and Supreme Court judges. They are in green. The yellow ones have the good sense to appoint their courts. We make our living in the green ones.
Judicial elections.
Yes, that's all we do, and we do it very quietly.
When our clients need help, we target a Supreme Court justice who is not particularly friendly, and we take him or her out of the picture.
Just like that. Just like that.
Who are your clients?
I can't give you names, but they're all on your side of the street. Big companies in energy, insurance, pharmaceuticals, chemicals, timber, all types of manufacturers, plus doctors, hospitals, nursing homes, banks. We raise tons of money and hire the people on the ground to run aggressive campaigns.
Have you worked in Mississippi?
Not yet.
Barry punched another button, and America was back. The green states slowly turned black.
The darker states are the ones we've worked in. As you can see, they're coast to coast. We maintain a presence in all 39.
Carl took some coffee and nodded as if he wanted Barry to keep talking.
We employ about 50 people here. The entire building is ours, and we accumulate enormous amounts of data. Information is power, and we know everything. We review every appellate decision in the green states. We know every appellate judge, their backgrounds, families, prior careers, divorces, bankruptcies, all the dirt. We review every decision and can predict the outcome of almost every case on appeal. We track every legislature and keep up with bills that might affect civil justice. We also monitor important civil trials.
How about the one in Hattiesburg?
Oh, yes. We were not at all surprised at the verdict.
Then why were my lawyers surprised?
Your lawyers were good, but not great. Plus, the plaintiff has a better case. I've studied a lot of toxic dumps, and Bowmore is one of the worst.
So we'll lose again.
That's my prediction. The flood is coming.
Carl glanced at the ocean and drank some more coffee.
What happens on appeal? Depends on who's on the Mississippi Supreme Court. Right now, there's a very good chance the verdict will be affirmed in a 5-4 decision. The state has been notoriously sympathetic to plaintiffs for the past 2 decades, and as you probably know, has a well-earned reputation as a hotbed of litigation. Asbestos, tobacco, fen-phen, all sorts of crazy class actions. Tort lawyers love the place.
So I'll lose by one vote?
More or less. The court is not entirely predictable, but yes, it's usually a 5-4 split.
So all we need is a friendly judge.
Yes.
Carl placed his cup on a table and shot to his feet. He slid out of his jacket, hung it over a chair, then walked to the windows and stared at the ocean. A cargo ship inched along a mile out, and he watched it for several minutes. Barry slowly sipped his coffee.
Do you have a judge in mind?
Carl finally asked. Barry hit the remote. The screen went blank, then disappeared into the ceiling. He stretched as if he had a sore back, then said,
Perhaps we should talk business first.
Carl nodded and took his chair.
Let's hear it.
Our proposal goes something like this. You hire our firm, the money gets wired into the proper accounts, then I will give you a plan for restructuring the Supreme Court of Mississippi.
How much?
There are two fees. First, $1 million as a retainer.
This is all properly reported. You officially become our client, and we provide consulting services in the area of government relations, a wonderfully vague term that covers just about anything. The second fee is $7 million, and we take it offshore. Some of this will be used to fund the campaign, but most will be preserved. Only the first fee goes on the books. Carl was nodding, understanding. For $8 million, I can buy myself a Supreme Court justice. That's the plan. And this judge earns how much a year? $110,000. $110,000, Carl repeated. It's all relative. Your mayor in New York City spent $75 million to get elected to a job that pays a tiny fraction of that. It's politics. Politics, Carl said as if he wanted to spit. He sighed heavily and slumped an inch or two in his chair. I guess it's cheaper than a verdict. Much cheaper. And there will be more verdicts. $8 million is a bargain. You make it sound so easy. It's not. These are bruising campaigns, but we know how to win them. I want to know how the money is spent. I want the basic plan. Barry walked over and replenished his coffee from a silver thermos. Then he walked to his magnificent windows and gazed out at the Atlantic. Carl glanced at his watch. He had a 12:30 tea time at the Palm Beach Country Club, not that it mattered that much. He was a social golfer who played because he was expected to play. Reinhardt drained his cup and returned to his chair. The truth, Mr. Trudeau, is that you really don't want to know how the money is spent. You want to win. You want a friendly face on the Supreme Court so that when Baker versus Crane Chemical is decided in 18 months, you'll be certain of the outcome. That's what you want. That's what we deliver. For $8 million, I would certainly hope so. You blew 18 on a bad piece of sculpture 3 nights ago, Barry thought, but wouldn't dare say. You have 3 jets that cost $40 million each. Your renovation in the Hamptons will set you back at least $10 million. And these are just a few of your toys. We're talking business here, not toys. Barry's file on Carl was much thicker than Carl's file on Barry. But then, in fairness, Mr. Reinhardt worked hard to avoid attention, while Mr. Trudeau worked even harder to attract it. It was time to close the deal. So Barry quietly pressed on. Mississippi has its judicial elections a year from now, next November. We have plenty of time, but none to waste. Your timing is convenient and lucky. As we slug it out through the election next year, the case plods along through the appellate process. Our new man will take office a year from January, and about 4 months later, we'll come face to face with Baker versus Crane Chemical. For the first time, Carl saw a flash of the car salesman, and it didn't bother him at all. Politics was a dirty business, where the winners were not always the cleanest guys in town. One had to be a bit of a thug to survive. My name cannot be at risk, he said sternly. Barry knew he had just collected another handsome fee. It's impossible, he said with a fake smile. We have firewalls everywhere. If one of our operatives gets out of line, does something wrong, we make sure another guy takes the fall. Troy Hogan has never even been remotely tarnished, and if they can't catch us, they damn sure can't find you. No paperwork. Only for the initial fee. We are, after all, a legitimate consulting and government relations firm. We will have an official relationship with you. Consulting, marketing, communications, all those wonderfully nebulous words that hide everything else. But the offshore arrangement is completely confidential. Carl thought for a long time, then smiled and said, I like it. I like it a lot.
Chapter 9. The law office of F. Clyde Hardin and Associates had no associates. It was just Clyde and Miriam, his feeble secretary, who outranked him because she had been there for over 40 years, far longer than Clyde. She had typed deeds and wills for his father, who came home from the Second War without a leg and was famous for removing his wooden one in front of juries to distract them. The old man was gone now, long gone. And he had bequeathed his old office and old furniture and old secretary to his only child, Clyde, who was 54 and very old himself. The Hardin Law Office had been a fixture on Main Street in Bowmore for over 60 years. It had survived wars, depressions, recessions, sit-ins, boycotts, and desegregation. But Clyde wasn't so sure it could survive Crane Chemical. The town was drying up around him. The nickname Cancer County was simply too much to overcome. From his ringside seat, he had watched merchants and cafes and country lawyers and country doctors throw in the towel and abandon the town. Clyde never wanted to be a lawyer, but his father gave him no choice. And though he survived on deeds and wills and divorces, and though he managed to appear reasonably happy and colorful with his seersucker suits, paisley bow ties, and straw hats, he silently loathed the law and the small-town practice of it. He despised the daily grind of dealing with people too poor to pay him, of hassling with other deadbeat lawyers trying to steal said clients, of bickering with judges and clerks, and just about everybody else who crossed his path. There were only 6 lawyers left in Bowmore, and Clyde was the youngest. He dreamed of retiring to a lake or a beach, anywhere, but those dreams would never come true. Clyde had sugared coffee and one fried egg at 8:30 every morning at Babe's, 7 doors to the right of his office, and a grilled cheese and iced tea every noon at Bob's Burgers, 7 doors to the left. At 5 every afternoon, as soon as Miriam had tidied up her desk and said goodbye, Clyde pulled out the office bottle and had a vodka on the rocks. He normally did this alone, in the solitude of the day, his finest hour. He cherished the stillness of his own little happy hour. Often the only sounds were the swishing of a ceiling fan and the rattling of his ice cubes. He had had 2 sips, gulps really, and the booze was beginning to glow somewhere in his brain when there was a rather aggressive knock on his door. No one was expected. Downtown was deserted by 5 every afternoon, but there was the occasional client looking for a lawyer. Clyde was too broke to ignore the traffic. He placed his tumbler on a bookshelf and walked to the front. A well-dressed gentleman was waiting. He introduced himself as Sterling Bitch, or something of that order. Clyde looked at his business card. Bentz, Sterling Bentz, attorney at law from Philadelphia, PA. Mr. Bentz was about 40 years old, short and thin, intense, with the smugness that Yankees can't help but exude when they venture into decaying towns of the Deep South. How could anyone live like this? Their smirks seemed to ask. Clyde disliked him immediately, but he also wanted to return to his vodka, so he offered Sterling a cocktail. Sure, why not? They settled around Clyde's desk and began to drink. After a few minutes of boring chit-chat, Clyde said, "Why don't you get to the point?" "Certainly." The accent was sharp and crisp and oh so grating. "My firm specializes in class actions for mass torts. That's all we do."
"And you're suddenly interested in our little town? What a surprise."
"Yes, we are interested. Our research tells us that there may be over 1,000 potential cases around here, and we'd like to sign up as many as possible. But we need local counsel."
"You're a bit late, bud. The ambulance chasers have been combing this place for the past 5 years."
"Yes, I understand that most of the death cases have been secured, but there are many other types. We'd like to find those victims with liver and kidney problems, stomach lesions, colon trouble, skin diseases, as many as 12 other afflictions, all caused, of course, by Crane Chemical. We screen them with our doctors, and when we have a few dozen, we hit Crane with a class action. This is our specialty. We do it all the time. The settlement could be huge."
Clyde was listening, but pretending to be bored.
"Go on," he said.
"Crane's been kicked in the crotch. They cannot continue to litigate, so they'll eventually be forced to settle. If we have the first class action, we're in the driver's seat."
"We?"
"Yes. My firm would like to associate with your firm."
"You're looking at my firm."
"We'll do all the work. We need your name as local counsel and your contacts and presence here in Bowmore."
"How much?"
Clyde was known to be rather blunt,
No sense mincing words with this little shyster from up north. $500 per client, then 5% of the fees when we settle. Again, we do all the work. Clyde rattled his ice cubes and tried to do the math. Sterling pressed on. The building next door is vacant.
Oh, yes. There are many vacant buildings here in Beaumont.
Who owns the one next door?
I do. It's part of this building. My grandfather bought it 1,000 years ago. I got one across the street, too. Empty.
The office next door is the perfect place for a screening clinic. We fix it up, give it a medical ambiance, bring in our doctors, then advertise like hell for anyone who thinks he or she might be sick. They'll flock in. We sign them up, get the numbers, then file a massive action in federal court.
It had the distinct ring of something fraudulent, but Clyde had heard enough about mass torts to know that Sterling here knew what he was talking about. 500 clients at $500 a pop, plus 5% when they won the lottery? He reached for the office bottle and refilled both glasses.
Intriguing, Clyde said.
It could be very profitable.
But I don't work in federal court.
Sterling sipped the near lethal serving and offered a smile. He knew perfectly well the limitations of this small-town blowhard. Clyde would have trouble defending a shoplifting case in city court.
Like I said, we do all the work. We're hardball litigators.
Nothing unethical or illegal, Clyde said.
Of course not. We've been winning class action and mass tort cases for 20 years. Check us out.
I'll do that.
And do it quick. This verdict is attracting attention. From now on, it's a race to find the clients and file the first class action.
After he left, Clyde had a third vodka, his limit, and near the end of it found the courage to tell all the locals to go to hell. Oh, how they would love to criticize him. Advertising for victims/clients in the county's weekly paper, turning his office into a cheap clinic for assembly line diagnoses, crawling into bed with some slimy lawyers from up north, profiting from the misery of his people. The list would be long, and the gossip would consume Beaumont. And the more he drank, the more determined he became to throw caution to the wind and for once try to make some money. For a character with such a blustery personality, Clyde was secretly afraid of the courtroom. He had faced a few juries years earlier and had been so stricken with fear that he could hardly talk. He had settled into a safe and comfortable office practice that paid the bills but kept him away from the frightening battles where the real money was made and lost. For once, why not take a chance? And wouldn't he be helping his people? Every dime taken from Crane Chemical and deposited somewhere in Beaumont was a victory. He poured a fourth drink, swore it was the last, and decided that, yes, damn it, he would hold hands with Sterling and his gang of class-action thieves and strike a mighty blow for justice. 2 days later, a subcontractor Clyde had represented in at least 3 divorces arrived early with a crew of carpenters, painters, and gophers, all desperate for work, and began a quick renovation of the office next door. Twice a month, Clyde played poker with the owner of the Beaumont News, the county's only paper. Like the town itself, the weekly was declining and trying to hang on. In its next edition, the front page was dominated by news about the verdict over in Hattiesburg, but there was also a generous story about Lawyer Hardin's association with a major national law firm from Philadelphia. Inside was a full-page ad that practically begged every citizen of Cary County to drop by the new diagnostic facility on Main Street for screening that was absolutely free. Clyde enjoyed the crowd and the attention and was already counting his money. It was 4 a.m., cold and dark with a threat of rain, when Buck Burleson parked his truck in the small employees' lot at the Hattiesburg pumping station. He collected his thermos of coffee, a cold biscuit with ham, and a 9mm automatic pistol, and carried it all to an 18-wheel rig with unmarked doors and a 10,000-gallon tanker as its payload. He started the engine and checked the gauges, tires, and fuel. The night supervisor heard the diesel and walked out of the second-floor monitoring room.
"Hello, Buck," he called down.
"Morning, Jake,"
Buck said with a nod.
"She loaded? Ready to go."
That part of the conversation had not changed in 5 years. There was usually an exchange about the weather, then a farewell. But on this morning, Jake decided to add a wrinkle to their dialogue, one he'd been contemplating for a few days.
"Those folks any happier over in Bowmore?"
"Damned if I know. I don't hang around."
And that was it. Buck opened the driver's door, gave his usual,
"See you later,"
and closed himself inside. Jake watched the tanker ease along the drive, turn left at the street, and finally disappear, the only vehicle moving at that lonesome hour. On the highway, Buck carefully poured coffee from the thermos into its plastic screw-on cup. He glanced at his pistol on the passenger seat. He decided to wait on the biscuit. When he saw the sign announcing Cary County, he glanced at his gun again. He made the trip 3 times a day, 4 days a week. Another driver handled the other 3 days. They swapped up frequently to cover vacations and holidays. It was not the career Buck had envisioned. For 17 years, he had been a foreman at Crane Chemical in Bowmore, earning 3 times what they now paid him to haul water to his old town. It was ironic that one of the men who had done so much to pollute Bowmore's water now hauled in fresh supplies of it. But irony was lost on Buck. He was bitter at the company for fleeing and taking his job with it, and he hated Bowmore because Bowmore hated him. Buck was a liar. This had been proven several times, but never in a more spectacular fashion than during a brutal cross-examination a month earlier. Mary Grace Payton had gently fed him enough rope, then watched him hang himself in front of the jury. For years, Buck and most of the supervisors at Crane had flatly denied any chemical dumping whatsoever. They were ordered to do so by their bosses. They denied it in company memos. They denied it when talking to company lawyers. They denied it in affidavits. And they certainly denied it when the plant was investigated by the Environmental Protection Agency and the U.S. Attorney's Office. Then the litigation began. After denying it for so long and so fervently, how could they suddenly flip their stories and tell the truth? Crane, after fiercely promoting the lying for so long, vanished. It escaped one weekend and found a new home in Mexico. No doubt some tortilla-eating jackass down there was doing Buck's job for $5 a day. He swore as he sipped his coffee. A few of the managers came clean and told the truth. Most clung to their lies. It didn't matter, really, because they all looked like fools at trial, at least those who testified. Some tried to hide. Earl Crouch, perhaps the biggest liar of all, had been relocated to a Crane plant near Galveston. There was a rumor that he had disappeared under mysterious circumstances. Buck again glanced at the 9mm. So far, he had only received one threatening phone call. He wasn't sure about the other managers. All had left Bowmore, and they did not keep in touch. Mary Grace Payton. If he'd had the pistol during his cross-examination, he might have shot her, her husband, and a few of the lawyers for Crane, and he would have saved one bullet for himself. For 4 devastating hours, she had exposed one lie after another. Some of the lies were safe, he had been told. Some were hidden away in memos and affidavits that Crane kept buried. But Ms. Payton had all the memos and all the affidavits and much more. When the ordeal was almost over, when Buck was bleeding and the jury was furious and Judge Harrison was saying something about perjury, Buck almost snapped. He was exhausted, humiliated, half delirious, and he almost jumped to his feet, looked at the jurors and said, "You want the truth? I give it to you. We dumped so much shit in those ravines, it's a wonder the whole town didn't explode. We dumped gallons every day. BCL and Cartilix and A-Clar, all class 1 carcinogens. Hundreds of gallons of toxic stuff directly into the ground. We dumped it from vats and buckets and barrels and drums. We dumped it at night and in broad daylight.
Oh, sure, we stored a lot of it in sealed green drums and paid a fortune to a specialty firm to haul it away. Crane complied with the law. They kissed the EPA's ass. You've seen the paperwork. Everything nice and proper. Real legal-like. While the starch shirts in the front office were filling out forms, we were out back in the pits burying the poison. It was much easier and much cheaper to dump it. And you know what? Those same assholes up front knew exactly what we were doing out back.
Here he would point a deadly finger at the Crane executives and their lawyers.
They covered it up, and they're lying to you right now. Everybody's lying.
Buck gave this speech out loud as he drove, though not every morning. It was oddly comforting to do so, to think about what he should have said instead of what he did. A piece of his soul and most of his manhood had been left behind in that courtroom. Lashing out in the privacy of his big truck was therapeutic. Driving to Bowmore, however, was not. He was not from there and had never liked the town. When he lost his job, he had no choice but to leave. As the highway became Main Street, he turned right and drove for four blocks. The distribution point had been given the nickname the City Tank. It was directly below the old water tower, an unused and decayed relic whose metal panels had been eaten from the inside by the city's water. A large aluminum reservoir now served the town. Buck pulled his tanker onto an elevated platform, killed the engine, stuffed the pistol into his pocket, and got out of the truck. He went about his business of unloading his cargo into the reservoir, a discharge that took 30 minutes. From the reservoir, the water would go to the town's schools, businesses, and churches, and though it was safe enough to drink in Hattiesburg, it was still greatly feared in Bowmore. The pipes that carried it along were, for the most part, the same pipes that had supplied the old water. Throughout the day, a constant stream of traffic arrived at the reservoir. The people pulled out all manner of plastic jugs and metal cans and small drums, filled them, then took them home. Those who could afford to contracted with private suppliers. Water was a daily challenge in Bowmore. It was still dark as Buck waited for his tank to empty. He sat in the cab with the heater on, door locked, pistol close by. There were two families in Pine Grove that he thought about each morning as he waited. Tough families, with men who'd served time. Big families, with uncles and cousins. Each had lost a kid to leukemia. Each was now suing. And Buck was a well-known liar. 8 days before Christmas, the combatants gathered for the last time in Judge Harrison's courtroom. The hearing was to wrap up all loose ends, and especially to argue the post-trial motions. Jared Curtin looked fit and tanned after 2 weeks of golf in Mexico. He greeted Wes warmly and even managed to smile at Mary Grace. She ignored him by talking to Jeanette, who still looked gaunt and worried, but at least wasn't crying. Curtin's pack of subordinates shuffled papers at hundreds of dollars an hour each, while Frank Sully, the local counsel, watched them smugly. It was all for show. Harrison wasn't about to grant any relief to Crane Chemical, and everybody knew it. Others were watching. Huffy held his usual spot, curious as always, still worried about the loan and his future. There were several reporters, and even a courtroom artist, the same one who had covered the trial and sketched faces that no one could recognize. Several plaintiff's lawyers were there to observe and to monitor the progress of the case. They were dreaming of a massive settlement that would allow them to become rich while avoiding the type of brutal trial the Paytons had just endured. Judge Harrison called things to order and charged ahead.
"So nice to see everyone again," he said dryly. "There are a total of 14 motions that have been filed, 12 by the defense, 2 by the plaintiff, and we are going to dispose of all of them before noon."
He glared at Jared Curtin, as if daring him to utter one superfluous word. He continued,
"I've read all the motions and all the briefs, so please don't tell me anything that you've already put in writing. Mr. Curtin,
You may proceed.
The first motion was for a new trial. Curtin quickly went through all the reasons his client got screwed, beginning with a couple of jurors he wanted to bounce, but Harrison refused. Curtin's team had conjured up a total of 22 errors they deemed grave enough to complain about, but Harrison felt otherwise. After listening to the lawyers argue for an hour, the judge ruled against the motion for a new trial. Jared Curtin would have been shocked at any other ruling. These were routine matters now. The battle had been lost, but not the war. The other motions followed. After a few minutes of uninspired argument on each one, Judge Harrison said,
"Overruled."
When the lawyers finished talking, and as papers were being gathered and briefcases were being closed, Jared Curtin addressed the court and said,
"Your Honor, it's been a pleasure. I'm sure we'll do the whole thing over in about 3 years."
"Court's adjourned,"
His Honor said rudely, then rapped his gavel loudly. 2 days after Christmas, late on a raw, windy afternoon, Jeanette Baker walked from her trailer through Pine Grove to the church and to the cemetery behind it. She kissed the small headstone at Chad's grave, then sat down and leaned against her husband Pete's. This was the day he died, 5 years earlier. In 5 years, she had learned to dwell on the good memories, though she couldn't get rid of the bad ones. Pete, a big man down to 120 pounds, unable to eat, finally unable to force water through the tumors in his throat and esophagus. Pete, 30 years old, and as gaunt and pale as a dying man twice that age. Pete, the tough guy, crying at the unrelenting pain and begging her for more morphine. Pete, the big talker and spinner of big tales, unable to emit anything but a pitiful groan. Pete, begging her to help him end it all. Chad's final days had been relatively calm. Pete's had been horrific. She had seen so much. Enough of the bad memories. She was there to talk about their life together, their romance, their first apartment in Hattiesburg, the birth of Chad, the plans for more children and a larger house, and all the dreams they once laughed about. Little Chad with a fishing pole and an impressive string of brim from her uncle's pond. Little Chad in his first T-ball uniform with Coach Pete by his side. Christmas and Thanksgiving, a vacation at Disney World when they were both sick and dying. She stayed until after dark, as she always did. Denny Ott watched her from the kitchen window of the parsonage. The little cemetery he maintained so carefully was getting more than its share of traffic these days. Chapter 10. The new year began with another funeral. Miss Inez Perdue died after a lengthy and painful deterioration of her kidneys. She was 61 years old, a widow with two adult children who had luckily left Beaumont as soon as they were old enough. Uninsured, she died in her small home on the outskirts of town, surrounded by friends and her pastor, Denny Ott. After he left her, Pastor Ott went to the cemetery behind the Pine Grove Church and, with the help of another deacon, began digging her grave, number 17. As soon as the crowd thinned, the body of Miss Inez was loaded into an ambulance and taken directly to the morgue at the Forest County Medical Center in Hattiesburg. There, a doctor hired by the Peyton Law Firm spent 3 hours removing tissue and blood and conducting an autopsy. Miss Inez had agreed to this somber procedure when she signed a contract with the Peytons a year earlier. A probe of her organs and an examination of her tissue might produce evidence that one day would be crucial in court. 8 hours after her death, she was back in Beaumont, in a cheap casket, tucked away for the night in the sanctuary of the Pine Grove Church. Pastor Ott had long since convinced his flock that once the body is dead and the spirit ascends into heaven, the earthly rituals are silly and of little significance. Funerals, wakes, embalming, flowers, expensive caskets, all were a waste of time and money. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
God sent us into the world naked, and that's how we should leave. The following day, he conducted Miss Inez's service before a full house that included Wes and Mary Grace, as well as a couple of other lawyers looking on with curiosity. During these services, and he was certainly becoming accomplished, Pastor Ott strove to make the occasion uplifting, at times even humorous. Miss Inez was the backup piano player for the church, and though she played with heavy hands and great enthusiasm, she usually missed about half the notes. And since she was practically deaf, she had no idea how bad she sounded. Recollections of her performances lightened the mood. It would be easy to bash Crane Chemical and its multitude of sins, but Pastor Ott never mentioned the company. She was dead, and nothing could change that. Everybody knew who killed her. After a one-hour service, the pallbearers lifted her wooden casket onto Mr. Earl Mangrum's authentic buckboard, the only one left in the county. Mr. Mangrum had been an early victim of Crane, burial number 3 in Denny Ott's career, and he specifically requested that his casket be hauled away from the church and to the cemetery on his grandfather's buckboard with his ancient mare Blaze under tack. The short procession had become such a hit that it became an instant tradition at Pine Grove. When Miss Inez's casket was placed on the carriage, Pastor Ott, standing next to Blaze, pulled her bridle, and the old quarter horse began lumbering along, leading the little parade away from the front of the church, down the side road, and back to the cemetery. Holding fast to the Southern tradition, her farewell was followed by a potluck get-together in the fellowship hall. For a people so accustomed to dying, the post-burial meal allowed the mourners to lean on one another and share their tears. Pastor Ott made the rounds, chatting with everyone, praying with some. The great question at these dark moments was, who was next? In many ways, they felt like prisoners, isolated, suffering, not sure which one would be chosen by the executioner. Rory Walker was a 14-year-old who was losing ground fast in his decade-long battle with leukemia. He was probably next. He was at school and missed the Purdue service, but his mother and grandmother were there. The Paytons huddled in a corner with Jeanette Baker and talked about everything but the case. Over paper plates sparsely covered with a broccoli and cheese casserole, they learned that she was now working as a night clerk in a convenience store and had her eye on a nicer trailer. She and Betty were fighting. Betty had a new boyfriend who slept over often and seemed much too interested in Jeanette's legal situation. Jeanette looked stronger, and her mind was sharper. She had gained a few pounds and said she was no longer taking all those antidepressants. People were treating her differently, she explained in a very low voice as she watched the others.
For a while, these people were really proud. We struck back. We won. Finally, somebody on the outside had listened to us. All these poor little people in this poor little town. Everybody circled around me and said sweet things. They cooked for me, cleaned the trailer. Somebody was always stopping by. Anything for poor little Jeanette. But as the days went by, I started hearing the money talk. How long will the appeal take? When will the money come in? What was I planning to do with it? And on and on. Betty's younger brother stayed over one night, drank too much, and tried to borrow $1,000. We got into a fight, and he said everybody in town knew that I'd already received some of the money. I was shocked. People were talking, all kinds of rumors. 20 million this and 20 million that. How much will I give away? What kind of new car am I going to get? Where will I build my big new house? They watch everything I buy now, which isn't much. And the men, every tomcat in 4 counties is calling, wanting to stop by and say hello or take me to the movies. I know for a fact that 2 of them aren't even divorced yet. Betty knows their cousins. I couldn't care less about men.
Wes glanced away. Are you talking to Denny? Mary Grace asked.
Some, and he's wonderful. He tells me to keep praying for those who gossip about me. I pray for him, all right. I really do.
but I get the feeling they're praying harder for me and the money.
She looked around suspiciously. Dessert was banana pudding. It was also an excuse to drift away from Jeanette. The Paytons had several other clients present, and each needed to be given some attention. When Pastor Ott and his wife began clearing the tables, the mourners finally headed for the door. Wes and Mary Grace met with Denny in his study, next to the sanctuary. It was time for the post-burial legal update. Who had fallen ill? What were the new diagnoses? Who in Pine Grove had hired another law firm? "This Clyde Harden thing is out of control," Denny said. "They're advertising on the radio and once a week in the paper, full page. They're almost guaranteeing money. People are flocking in." Wes and Mary Grace had walked down Main Street prior to the service for Miss Inez. They wanted to see firsthand the new screening clinic next to F. Clyde's office. On the sidewalk, there were two large coolers filled with bottled water and packed with ice. A teenager with a Benson Bents t-shirt handed them a bottle each. The label read, "Pure Spring Water, Compliments of Bents and Bents Attorneys." There was a toll-free number. "Where does the water come from?" Wes had asked the kid. "Not from Bowmore," came the quick retort. As Mary Grace chatted up the boy, Wes stepped inside where he joined three other potential clients who were waiting to get themselves screened. None gave any indication of being ill. Wes was greeted by a comely young lady of no more than 18 who handed him a brochure, a form on a clipboard, and a pen and instructed him to fill out both front and back. The brochure was professionally done and gave the basics of the allegations against Crane Chemical, a company now proven in court to have contaminated the drinking water of Bowmore and Cary County. All inquiries were directed to the firm of Benson Bents in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The questions on the form were all background and medical, except for the last two. One, who referred you to this office? And two, do you know anyone else who might be a potential victim of Crane Chemical? If so, list names and phone numbers. As Wes was scribbling on the form, the doctor entered the waiting room from somewhere in the rear and called for the next patient. He wore a white physician's office jacket, complete with a stethoscope around his neck. He was either Indian or Pakistani and looked no older than 30. After a few minutes inside, Wes excused himself and left. "It's small-time stuff," Wes said to Denny. "They'll sign up a few hundred cases, most of them frivolous. Then they'll file a class action in federal court. If they're lucky, it'll be settled years from now for a few thousand bucks each. The lawyers will skim off some nice fees, but there's a better chance that Crane will never settle. And if that happens, then all those new clients get nothing, and Clyde Harden will be forced to go back to drafting deeds."
"How many from your church have signed up?"
Mary Grace asked.
"I don't know. They don't tell me everything."
"We're not worried about it," Wes said. "Frankly, we have enough of these cases to keep us busy for a long time."
"Did I see a couple of spies at the service today?" Mary Grace asked.
"Yes. One was a lawyer named Crandall from Jackson. He's been hanging around since the trial. He's actually stopped by here to say hello. Just a hustler."
"I've heard of him," Wes said.
"Has he hooked any cases?"
"Not from this church."
They discussed the lawyers for a while, then had their usual conversation about Jeanette and the new pressures she was facing. Ott was spending time with her and was confident she was listening to him. After an hour, they wrapped up their meeting. The Paytons drove back to Hattiesburg, another client in the ground, another injury case now converted into a wrongful death suit. The preliminary paperwork arrived at the Mississippi Supreme Court in the first week of January. The trial transcript, 16,200 pages, was finalized by the court reporters, and copies were sent to the clerk of the court and to the lawyers. An order was entered giving Crane Chemical, the appellant, 90 days to file its brief. 60 days after that, the Paytons would file their rebuttal. In Atlanta, Jared Curtin passed the file to the firm's appellate unit, the Eggheads, as they were known,
brilliant legal scholars who functioned poorly in normal circles and were best kept in the library. Two partners, four associates, and four paralegals were already hard at work on the appeal when the massive transcript arrived, and they had their first look at every word that was recorded at trial. They would dissect it and find dozens of reasons for a reversal. In a lesser section of Hattiesburg, the transcript was plopped on the plywood table in the pit. Mary Grace and Sherman gawked at it in disbelief, almost afraid to touch it. Mary Grace had once tried a case that went on for 10 full days. Its transcript had been 1,200 pages long, and she read it so many times that the sight of it made her ill. Now this. If they had an advantage, it was because they had been in the courtroom throughout the entire trial and knew most of what was in the transcript. Indeed, Mary Grace appeared on more pages than any other participant. But it would be read many times, and procrastination was not an option. The trial and its verdict would be cleverly and savagely attacked by Crane's lawyers. Jeanette Baker's lawyers had to match them, argument for argument, word for word. In the heady days after the verdict, the plan had been for Mary Grace to concentrate on the Bowmore cases while Wes worked on files to generate income. The publicity had been priceless. The phones rang incessantly. Every nutcase in the Southeast suddenly needed the Paytons. Lawyers mired in hopeless lawsuits called for help. Family members who had lost loved ones to cancer saw the verdict as a hopeful sign. And the usual assortment of criminal defendants, divorcing spouses, battered women, bankrupt businesses, slip-and-fall hustlers, and fired employees called or even stopped by in pursuit of these famous lawyers. Very few could pay a decent fee. Legitimate personal injury cases, however, had proven scarce. The big one, the perfect case with clear liability and a defendant with deep pockets, the case upon which retirement dreams often rest, had not yet found its way to the Payton Law Firm. There were a few more car wrecks and workers' compensation cases, but nothing worth a trial. Wes worked feverishly to close as many files as possible, and with some success. The rent was now current, at least at the office. All past due wages had been paid. Huffy and the bank were still on edge, but afraid to push harder. No payments had been made, either on principal or on interest. Chapter 11. They settled on a man named Ron Fisk, a lawyer unknown outside of his small town of Brookhaven, Mississippi, an hour south of Jackson, 2 hours west of Hattiesburg, and 50 miles north of the Louisiana state line. He was elected from a pool of similar resumes, though none of those considered had the slightest hint that their names and backgrounds were being so carefully evaluated. Young white male, one marriage, 3 children, reasonably handsome, reasonably well-dressed, conservative, devout Baptist, Ole Miss Law School, no ethical glitches in the law career, not a hint of criminal trouble beyond a speeding ticket, no affiliation with any trial lawyer group, no controversial cases, no experience whatsoever on the bench. There was no reason anyone outside of Brookhaven would ever have heard the name of Ron Fisk, and that was exactly what made him their ideal candidate. They picked Fisk because he was just old enough to cross their low threshold of legal experience, but still young enough to have ambitions. He was 39 years old, a junior partner in a 5-man firm that specialized in defending lawsuits involving car wrecks, arson, injured workers, and a myriad of other routine liability claims. The firm's clients were insurance companies who paid by the hour, thus allowing the 5 partners to earn comfortable but not lucrative salaries. As a junior partner, Fisk made $92,000 the year before, a far cry from Wall Street, but not bad money in small-town Mississippi. A Supreme Court justice was currently earning $110,000. Fisk's wife, Doreen, earned $41,000 as the assistant director of a privately owned mental health clinic. Everything was mortgaged, home, both cars, even some furniture. But the Fisks had a perfect credit rating. They vacationed once a year with their children in Florida, where they rented a condo in a high-rise for $1,000 a week. There were no trust funds and nothing significant to be expected from their parents' estates. The Fisks were squeaky clean. There was nothing to dig up in the heat of a nasty campaign. Absolutely nothing. They were certain of that. Tony Zachary entered the building at 5 minutes before 2 p.m. and stated his business.
"I have an appointment with Mr. Fisk," he said politely, and a secretary disappeared.
As he waited, he examined the place, sagging bookshelves laden with dusty tomes, worn carpet, the musty smell of a fine old building in need of some work. A door opened, and a handsome young man stuck out a hand.
"Mr. Zachary, Ron Fisk," he said warmly, as he probably did to all new clients.
"A pleasure."
"This is my office," Fisk said, sweeping his hand at the door. They walked through it, closed it, then settled around a large, busy desk. Zachary declined coffee, water, a soda.
"I'm fine, thanks," he said.
Fisk had his sleeves rolled up and his tie loosened, as if he had been performing manual labor. Zachary liked the image immediately. Nice teeth, just a touch of gray above the ears, strong chin. This guy was definitely marketable. They played Who Do You Know for a few minutes, with Zachary claiming to be a longtime resident of Jackson, where he had spent most of his career in government relations, whatever that meant. Since he knew that Fisk had no history of political involvement, he had little fear of being exposed. In truth, he had lived in Jackson less than 3 years, and until very recently, had worked as a lobbyist for an association of asphalt contractors. There was a state senator from Brookhaven they both knew, and they chatted about him for a few minutes, anything to pass the time. When things were comfortable, Zachary said,
"Let me apologize. I'm really not a new client. I'm here on some much more important business."
Fisk frowned and nodded. "Keep talking, sir."
"Have you ever heard of a group called Judicial Vision?"
"No." Few people had. In the murky world of lobbying and consulting, Judicial Vision was a newcomer. Zachary moved on.
"I'm the executive director for the state of Mississippi. It's a national group. Our sole purpose is to elect quality people to the appellate courts. By quality, I mean conservative, business-oriented, temperate, highly moral, intelligent, and ambitious young judges who can literally, Mr. Fisk, and this is the core of what we believe, change the judicial landscape of this country. And if we can do that, then we can protect the rights of the unborn, restrict the cultural garbage that is consumed by our children, honor the sanctity of marriage, keep homosexuals out of our classrooms, fight off the gun control advocates, seal our borders, and protect the true American way of life."
Both took a deep breath. Fisk wasn't sure where he fit into this raging war, but his pulse was definitely up 10 beats per minute.
"Yes, well, sounds like an interesting group," he said.
"We're committed," Zachary said firmly. "And we're also determined to bring sanity back to our civil litigation system. Runaway verdicts and hungry trial lawyers are robbing us of economic advancement. We're scaring companies away from Mississippi, not attracting them."
"There's no doubt about that," Fisk said, and Zachary wanted to shout for joy.
"You see all the frivolous stuff they file? We work hand in hand with the national tort reform groups."
"That's good. And why are you in Brookhaven?"
"Are you politically ambitious, Mr. Fisk? Ever thought about tossing your hat in the ring for elective office?"
"Not really."
"Well, we've done our research, and we think you'd be an excellent candidate for the Supreme Court."
Fisk instinctively laughed at such foolishness, but it was the sort of nervous laugh that leads you to believe that whatever is supposed to be humorous is really not. It's serious. It can be pursued.
Research? He said.
Oh, yes. We spend a lot of time looking for candidates who, A, we like, and B, can win. We study the opponents, the races, the demographics, the politics, everything, really. Our data bank is unmatched, as is our ability to generate serious funds. Care to hear more?
Fisk kicked back in his reclining rocker, put his feet on his desk, and his hands behind his head, and said,
Sure. Tell me why you're here. I'm here to recruit you to run against Justice Sheila McCarthy this November in the Southern District of Mississippi, he announced confidently. She is very beatable. We don't like her or her record. We have analyzed every decision she's made in her 9 years on the bench, and we think she's a raging liberal who manages to hide her true colors most of the time. Do you know her?
Fisk was almost afraid to say yes. We met once, just in passing. I don't really know her. Actually, according to their research, Justice McCarthy had participated in 3 rulings in cases involving Ron Fisk's law firm, and each time she had ruled the other way. Fisk had argued one of the cases, a hotly disputed arson mess involving a warehouse. His client lost on a 5-4 vote. It was quite likely that he had little use for Mississippi's only female justice.
She's very vulnerable, Zachary said.
What makes you think I can beat her?
Because you are a clean-cut conservative who believes in family values. Because of our expertise in running blitzkrieg campaigns. Because we have the money.
We do?
Oh, yes. Unlimited. We partner with some powerful people, Mr. Fisk.
Please, call me Ron.
It'll be Ronnie Boy before you know it. Yes, Ron. We coordinate the fundraising with groups that represent banks, insurance companies, energy companies, big business. I'm talking serious cash here, Ron. Then we expand the umbrella to include the groups that are dearest to us. The conservative Christian folks, who, by the way, can produce huge sums of money in the heat of a campaign. Plus, they turn out the vote.
You make it sound easy.
It's never easy, Ron, but we seldom lose. We've honed our skills in a dozen or so races around the country, and we're making a habit of pulling off victories that surprise a lot of people.
I've never sat on the bench.
We know that, and that's why we like you. Sitting judges make tough decisions. Tough decisions are sometimes controversial. They leave trails, records that opponents can use against them. The best candidates, we have learned, are bright young guys like yourself who don't carry the baggage of prior decisions.
Inexperience had never sounded so good,